This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Come on, girl.
You are now entering Place to Be Nation Sports Lounge, and here are your hosts, Roger Morissette, Andrew Flanagan, and Chad Campbell.
I'm talking rainforest sweaty. I'm talking swamp sweaty. Let's fill the bathtub full of sweat.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the inaugural Place to Be Nation Sports Lounge. I'm the one they call Cowboy, Roger Morissette, and I'm here with Andy Flanagan. He goes by the Lone Ranger sometimes, or just Andy, and Chaddy Oakley, C Squared, our man in Georgia, Chad Campbell. Being that it's the inaugural episode, I want to give you guys an overview of what the show is going to be. So we're your thinking man sports podcast. We're deep diving into different sports issues on a bi-weekly basis. We're going to have experts on for baseball, for football, for MMA. There's going to be an MMA segment every week, and we really want you to tune in because this is the best sports podcast that Place to Be Nation has to offer. So, how are you doing tonight, Andy?
I'm doing quite well.
Chad?
I'm doing great.
Excellent, excellent. So, we're going to start things off with a look at the NFL draft. As everyone's aware, the NFL draft was about 2 weeks ago. Being that it's our first podcast, we haven't had a chance to discuss that with you, and it was a real interesting night. So, the way that we've done this is each one of us has taking a team, we're going to deep dive into that team, and we're going to discuss things. So, why don't you start us off, Chad, with the team of the hour, with the man of the hour, Johnny Football, and the Cleveland Browns.
Yeah, so the Cleveland Browns, I think, obviously probably had the most interesting draft, in my opinion, only because of the moves they made and the fact that they got Manziel, who was kind of the linchpin to see in the whole draft where he would go, what would end up of him. I think the Browns were certainly one of the higher candidates to land him, and they did, but it was kind of strategic in how they did it. And if you think about my location-wise, geographically, as a person from Georgia, it doesn't get in a lot of ways more boring than the Cleveland Browns. I mean, that is just a kind of generic team that I've never really gave much thought about, a team that doesn't feel like they have much cachet. So I'm kind of buying into them with Johnny Manziel. It's being more exciting and at least mixing it up a little bit, and certainly more a team I'm going to be paying attention to as we go into the 2014 season. So as we know, the Browns had the number 4 pick originally in the draft. They ended up trading that back with the Bills, who moved up, and they'll end up getting the Bills' 2015 first and fourth round draft picks. So that I thought that was, and it's been kind of hashed over, but I thought that was a brilliant trade on their part. Really kind of the way that the cards fell out went to their advantage, and even if it hadn't, I think they could have drafted someone like Teddy. If Manziel would have went earlier, I think somebody like Teddy Bridgewater would have still been there at the end of the first round when they selected again. So they had multiple options to work with. So I thought that was a brilliant pick for them. Especially could pay off big dividends next year with that first round from the Bills, because I don't think the Bills are going to be any great shake, so that could be a high pick as well. So their first pick, they selected Justin Gilbert, cornerback from Oklahoma State, and he was the guy that I had watched a good bit and was aware of coming into the NFL draft. I watch a lot of college football, mainly SEC, but dabble in the other conferences. And One of the themes that I think it's safe to say throughout the Browns draft with a lot of their guys is a lot of them seemed like kind of high risk, high reward type picks in many ways. And Justin Gilbert fits into that model. I mean, he's a safe pick and he was a highly regarded pick, but he ran incredibly fast at the combine. He had a 4.3140. Which was tied for the fastest time of any quarterbacks at the combine. He also did 20 reps on the 225 bench press, so he showed some great kind of muscle definition there. 35.5 vertical jump, and to kind of compare him to Denard from Michigan State, who most pundits had either Gilbert or Denard 1 and 2 in their cornerback ratings. Denard ran a 4.4140, and he only did 15 reps on the 225 bench. So just in those raw stats, Gilbert was faster and stronger. Phillip Gaines from Rice was the only one that matched his 40 time, but again, he only did 11 reps on the bench. So he's a really good tackler, really physical guy. But at times, and I did watch a good many of his kind of YouTube clips that were put together, and you could tell from sometimes that he liked to gamble. He certainly gambled a good bit, which can be kind of a blessing and a curse at the cornerback position. And his technical footwork, I thought, struggled a little bit where he'd get turned around and then would have to recover. And at the college level, he was able to recover with his ferocious speed. But in the NFL level, he's going to have to work on some of those kind of technical abilities when he's matched up against as fast or faster wide receivers. So that was their first pick. I don't think you can criticize that too much. Seemed like a good choice. Someone that should probably be their opening day starter at cornerback on opposite side from Joe Hayden. Their next pick, of course, was pick number 22, pick Johnny Manziel. I don't think you can say much more about him. But one thing I did want to look at him was, of course, there's the weight and the height issue. So I went through all the quarterbacks in the league and found out that him and Drew Brees are almost identical. It is actually pretty shocking how close they are, both height and weight-wise. Russell Wilson is a little bit shorter, actually, than Manziel. RG3 is about 10 to 15 pounds heavier and an inch or two taller. And then he's the same height as Vic as well. So Manziel, while he is undersized compared to about 25 of the quarterbacks in the league, he does have some kind of counterparts that are also the same height and size as him. And I think one thing with Manziel too is we know he's the first redshirt freshman to win the Heisman, and he carries so much hype with him, but it's tough to talk about intangibles, and you never know how they'll translate to the NFL level. But he always has been someone that really felt like he had a chip on his shoulder and someone that was out to prove something. He was only a 3-star recruit for both Rivals and Scout coming out of his high school in Texas. He was a Texas Longhorns fan but was never recruited from them. So he kind of did have to overcome some stuff, which he certainly will translate into the NFL as well. But he does seem to have a determination and something in his gene pool that helps him to push through with that. One thing in his advantage is he does have large hands. He has 9 7/8 inch hands. His 40-yard dash time, I thought, was fairly high, actually, at 4.68, and he scored a 32 on the Wonderlick. So, for Johnny Football, kind of intelligent, I guess, but for somebody that has that moniker. Now, I think most people are sort of comparing him to Russell Wilson. Seems to be the closest comparison of a current NFL quarterback, someone that has won a Super Bowl. I mean, how much of that was him you know, you can debate, but he certainly, I think, was helpful to his team. He certainly didn't hinder the Seahawks this past year. So Russell Wilson had a faster 40 time, and he had bigger hands. And Russell Wilson was not selected until the third round of the NFL draft. So that kind of is where you can see maybe even though Manziel went later than a lot of people originally thought, he was still selected two full rounds ahead of Russell Wilson, who coming out of college stat-wise – Manziel, of course, crushes him with his college stats, but as far as their peripherals, they're pretty comparable. So those were their first-round picks. Then in the second round, they grabbed at pick number 35, a big hoss, Joe Petonio. Now, he had a average rank of number 3 in his position from all the tracking sites that I looked at. They kind of graded out around there. He was a tackle at Nevada, but he'll be transitioning to guard in the NFL because of his size. He's right at 300 pounds, 6'4". Now, I watched a lot of highlights with him because I was not well-versed in Nevada throughout the college season, and I thought he looked really good. Especially there was a ton of clips of him handling some top competition when they faced Pac-12 opponents, including Anthony Barr. He pretty much was able to contain Anthony Barr when they faced UCLA, and I think this was probably, if I had to say, the safest pick in the whole Browns draft. From being a bust, I would actually pick Joel over Gilbert or Manziel. I think he looked like a solid NFL starter from what I saw, and I see him contending for a starting job versus Jason Pinkston, who they have right now at that guard position, and I actually see Joel kind of overtaking that and being the opening day starter going into the season. Then that was pick number 35. They didn't pick again until pick number 71 when they selected Christian Kirksey, outside linebacker from Iowa. Now, this seemed like a pretty big reach for the Browns. Most people had him pegged kind of going a round or two later. But this is kind of where the Browns running that 3-4 scheme in the defense, they need to have a heavy rotation of linebackers, and Kirksey kind of fits into that, where he may be able to get into the 6-7-8-man rotation they could possibly throw out there with their linebacking core. He did 16 reps on the 225 bench press, and he's a really long and kind of lanky player, and you talk about kind of a headhunter type player that you do like to see from the linebacker position. He has some thundering, ferocious hits based on his highlights, picking people up and German suplexing them and slamming them on the ground. So that looked good. But on the downside of that, for every kind of vicious tackle he had, there seemed to be at least one clip or a couple clips of him gambling a lot, lowering his head, and being able to be evaded by some shifty running backs. So that is something he'll have to work on staying true to form as he goes to the next level. Now, the last two picks from the Browns in the whole NFL draft, first of all, they didn't have any picks after round 4. So that was kind of interesting with their whole draft. They ended up trading the number 22 and number 26. They traded the number 22 pick with the Eagles for the number 20, or they moved up and they gave them the number 26 and the number 83 pick. So that was the trade they made with the Eagles to get Manziel. Their last two picks, though, pick number 94 was Terrence West from Townsend. Now, I'll just tell you, their last pick was Pierre Desir, who's another cornerback from Lindenwood. Now, is somebody that feels pretty comfortable in their college football knowledge. If you handed me a map of the United States, I don't know if I could be within a 4 or 5 state reach of selecting where Towson and Lindenwood is located. so these were kind of definitely your your under the radar type choices, I thought. But West had some hype coming in with the running back, and the running back draft I thought this year was extremely interesting with no one going until very late. Now, West is kind of one of those bolder type running backs instead of a straight speed guy. He's short and compact. His 4.51 40 time was not that bad for someone that has that type of frame on him. Maybe a third down option I could possibly see if he's able to get into the rotation, because he is good at catching balls from the backfield. But that the running back position with the Browns right now is getting fairly crowded. Maybe not necessarily with stars, but with depth. So they have they signed Ben Tate. They have Deion Lewis, who seems to be lingering around as a backup quarterback every single year. And then also, even though he went undrafted, they did sign my boy Isaiah Crowell, formerly of Georgia fame, who is more of a speedster type running back that could be complemented with West. And I would actually see, I kind of foresee West and Crowell fighting in training camp for the third running back spot on the roster, and we'll see which way they go after that. Their last pick was Pierre Desir, pick 127. They got it as a fourth round, so this was actually kind of a value pick. Many had him as a third-round pick from what I saw. He's 6'1", 200 pounds. He's very tall, very lean. But and we've seen these mid-majors and even Division I AA players work well in the NFL level in some cases, but I do think the competition issue has to be addressed, because when you're facing someone at Lindenwood, which I took a peek at their schedule just to see who they faced, and they didn't even have any opponents versus a known name. And oddly enough, just I found this fascinating. One week they faced Missouri Southern State University and lost 55-0. Then the next week they faced Haskell University and won 57-7. So that's a pretty wide discrepancy from a week to week. But Desir, he was a 3-time Division II All-American. And he's very good at kind of tight slot coverage with his frame there, how lean and tall he is. But I think this was more kind of just a stockpile, some cornerbacks. Maybe if Gilbert flames out, Desir can rise above the ranks. So at the fourth round, I thought this was a fine pick, but felt like more of an adding depth option by the Browns. And that kind of concluded their draft.
Thanks, Chad. That's some great analysis there that you should come to expect here at the Sports Lounge. Just to give you my take on the Browns, what I really liked about the Justin Gilbert pick is the fact that they already have Joe Hayden.
Yeah.
So Gilbert, it really reminds me of the Jets with Revis and Cromartie, with Gilbert in that Cromartie role, where maybe he's a little bit more raw, but he's such a physical freak, and he's not going to have to step in and be that number one guy, because Hayden's that number one guy, that I think it's a great pick for them and gives them one of the top secondaries in the AFC. And I loved the Manziel pick. I think I loved it more than most. I'm a big fan of Johnny Football, and I think that the value that they got with the trade was just phenomenal. And we'll get into some other teams that maybe didn't draft for the same type of value. But overall, I thought the Browns did a great job. What do you think, Andy?
Yeah, I think you guys covered it. I don't have much to add. I think I've said before that they played it right. You know, they picked up that first rounder from Buffalo, which could be huge next year. And they still got the quarterback they wanted, and they got the cornerback they wanted. So, I mean, it's hard to consider it anything other than a big success for the Browns.
Yeah, as someone that kind of had to suffer through Desmond Trufant being selected in the first round and to be the star cornerback of a team with the Falcons this year, I don't think you can underrate the ability that Gilbert has where he can be on that right-hand side and have Hayden across the line from him so he can be a true number two with backup behind him.
Absolutely, absolutely. So so next up, we're going to have Andy cover the Minnesota Vikings, another very interesting draft with a high-profile quarterback and some interesting moves along the way. So I'm going to pass it to Andy.
All right. Well, like Cleveland, they had their pick of quarterbacks. Well, Bortles was gone. Who knows how much they liked him. But they could have gone quarterback at number eight, but they instead went with Anthony Barr. And I guess the success of this draft kind of depends on how you feel about him. Some scouts saw him as a project who could take some time to pan out, and other people had him rated really highly. Some scouts had him above Khalil Mack, which I think is crazy. But if you like Barr, then that's the, you know, if they had him, who knows if they had him rated above the quarterbacks or if they just thought they had a chance to get them later and that Barr wouldn't be around at that point. So then later in the draft, they were able to trade up from the second round into the end of the first to pick up Bridgewater, which I'm quickly becoming the Bridgewater's biggest fan at Place to Be a Nation somehow. I just, obviously, you know, this isn't my job. I don't scout NFL players for a living, but I just feel like they're overthinking it. They're looking at the weaknesses, like he's not that big. He doesn't quite have NFL size. His hands are kind of small, but, you know, his hands are about the same size as Kaepernick's hands. And, you know, he hasn't been a huge problem for him, obviously. I think the one skill that we know Bridgewater has is that he can handle the pass rush in an NFL-style offense, and that seems to be the hardest skill to teach to a quarterback. And I wonder why we're underrating that to the point where all these other measurables are overpowering that. So I obviously like the pick. I think it was a big win for them. They gave up a fourth rounder, which isn't nothing, but it's not a big loss either. It's not like giving away your first round pick the next year like the Bills did. Later on in the draft, they also picked up Scott Crichton from Oregon State, another pass rusher. Between him and Barr, they should have enough to replace the loss of Jared Allen. They picked up some offensive line help with David Yankee, who had a pretty good grade going into the year, but then didn't play that great at Stanford. But it's a good value pick at that point. And they picked up Anton Exum, who also had a good grade, but has some injury concerns that could pay off. It's worth the risk at that point. I think it was like a fifth-round pick. And they picked up some other secondary help with Kendall James and Jabari Price. And overall, I think it's pretty good. I like Bridgewater, and it really depends on how Barr plays out. What do you guys think?
Thanks, Andy. Great analysis there. I really, really didn't like the Barr pick. Really.
Yeah, you're not a fan, I'm aware.
You know, I can't say enough how bad of a value he is at number nine. I've heard the comparison, at least what I see, is that he could be the next Aaron Maben, who is, you know, no long first round guy, straight line pass rusher, who's no longer in the NFL. And again, I've said it before, but the NFL draft is about value. Could Barr turn out to be a good player? Sure. Could you have gotten him at 25? Probably. So why take him number nine? I think they saved themselves a bit with the Bridgewater pick. I'm with Andy. I like Teddy Bridgewater. I don't think a guy should be massively downgraded as he was based on a bad pro day. I watched a lot of him in college, and I think he's got great skills, great intangibles, and I think he's one of those guys that's just he's better on the field than maybe
running around in shorts.
Yeah, than running around with shorts or. You know, so to use a basketball reference, you know, he looks better posting up the player than posting up the chair.
And I think Bridgewater is going to be a good quarterback. And since he's been there, he said all the right things. And I mean, it's looking very much like he could very well be their number one on opening day. And I think he could be a steal. So I think you have one good pick there with one extremely bad pick. how do you feel, Chad?
I mean, I do think the bar pick was a reach where they got him, but I don't know. I mean, I did watch a lot of him. Kind of my thing in the fall on Saturday nights is when I come back from doing whatever, according to what my blood alcohol level content at the time is, but I'll fall asleep kind of either halfway paying attention or fully paying attention to one of the Pac-12 games. So I was able to see a lot of Anthony Barr. At least I was actually able to see double Anthony Barr on some occasions based on my condition. But I do think he could be good, but he does have some work that needs to be done. I think there's no doubt about that. I agree with the Bridgewater stuff. I'm always fascinated how, I mean, it just seems like every year in September and October you have a guy that's a surefire number one pick or top three pick in the NFL draft, and then by the time the draft rolls around, something's just happened. I mean, Geno Smith last year felt like that when he was running rampant over everyone at West Virginia, and then Teddy Bridgewater really felt like that for a while he was at Louisville, even up to like November, and I would even say, I guess, until his terrible pro day or whatever did it, yeah, become kind of aware that he was not going to be selected or probably even heavily considered by the Texans. As far as the rest of their draft, the one guy that I did watch a ton of was Brandon Watts, who they got really deep all the way in round 7. Yeah. Linebacker at Georgia Tech. My dad's a Georgia Tech grad, so he's the one Georgia Tech fan for football in the state of Georgia. But he follows it closely. And Brandon Watts, he was very good. I thought that was a good pick there. How much he'll be able to translate that into the pros remains to be seen, but I thought in round 7 that was kind of a good pickup to fill out their linebacking core.
Great. Thanks, Chad. And, I'm up next here. So I was tasked with reviewing the Jacksonville Jaguars draft. Always a good time, given their historical ineptitude. So I think it's a tale of kind of two drafts for the Jaguars. You have their first pick, and then all the other picks. So, the first pick, they took Blake Bortles at number 3. To say I'm not a fan of this pick would be understating it. I think it's a bad value. I think, you know, the next quarterback didn't go until 22, Manziel. They didn't have to take Bortles at 3. And I don't personally think he was the right quarterback to take. I thought Manziel or Bridgewater were better options. I think Bortles is more of the combine guy. He really looks the part. Didn't quite have the same level of success in college. And, you know, frankly, for a team that got burned like they did with Blaine Gabbert, he reminds me a ton of Blaine Gabbert, and I just don't understand why you would make that pick. One of his issues is, you know, that his mechanics break down under pressure, and you know their offensive line's terrible, so he's gonna be under pressure, and it's just typical of this franchise and why they're consistently one of the worst in the NFL, in my opinion. But I said enough about that on our sister podcast, the Place to Be Nation Extra Point. So what we didn't talk about there was the rest of their draft, where I thought they actually, you know, they actually dusted themselves off from that disaster at number 3 and did very well. I thought Marquise Lee at 39 was a great pick. He's projected to go in the first round, and I'm sure we've all watched a lot of USC football, and That kid can play, and that kid's going to step right in and be a weapon for Chad Henne this year. I'm not sure Chad Henne's going to be able to get him the ball, but he'll probably be open a lot. Allen Robinson's another good value where they got him, and I think, you know, I do like the fact that they're trying to set Bortles up for success by investing a couple of high picks in receivers. Obviously, with Justin Blackmon suspended for the whole season, most likely, and really his career's in doubt. I mean, the last I heard, they hadn't even heard from him. It's such a sad story for such a talented guy. But I mean, they really have to move on as if he's not going to be there. And then anything they maybe get out of him is a bonus. So I think they really address those needs with those two receivers to add to Cecil Shorts, who I think is a pretty underrated receiver, and I think is a pretty legit number one over there. Again, if he had someone who could get him the ball, I think we could really see what he could do. I like the Brandon Linder pick on the guard. Is, you know, so similar to the Browns guard pick. I think it's a safe pick, and he will probably be able to step in right away. Aaron Colvin from Oklahoma. May not get much out of him this year, given that he's coming off that ACL that he tore at the Senior Bowl. But, you know, prior to that, he was projected to have most likely gone in the late first, early second round. So I think that's a good value pick there. And overall, like I said, I think they did a great job outside of the Bortles pick. But the problem is that if I'm right, and that's another top 10 whiff at quarterback, which, I mean, I really think it's a whiff, and I hate to say it, and you never know, but if it is, you're not going to be a successful franchise consistently whiffing when you're drafting quarterbacks in the top 10. I mean, Gabbert is probably the biggest bust at that high in the draft since Akili Smith, which is really saying something, because there have been some busts, and he was just looked like he never threw a football before when they put him into the lineup. And hopefully I'm wrong about Bortles for the sake of the people of Jacksonville, but
there are many fans.
Yes, there are many fans, but I think Bortles is their one-way ticket to London. What do you guys think?
Go ahead, John.
Go ahead.
Damn it. I'm mostly just mystified. I mean, clearly Cleveland and Minnesota felt like they could wait on quarterbacks and get other value picks that high. So I don't know if Jacksonville thought that some other team was in love with Bortles and that was their only chance. Did they even try to trade down? I mean, like we've talked about before, this was like a four-player draft. That third pick was incredibly valuable. And to use it on Bortles when it looks like no other team was very interested in trading in picking a quarterback very high, I can't imagine what they were thinking.
They could have gotten Buffalo's first right. round pick next year, obviously,
and probably could have gotten Bortles at 9, wherever.
Right, I would say definitely could have gotten Bortles at 9. What do you think there, Chad?
Yeah, I mean, as I kind of talked before I started the Cleveland Browns analysis about how seems, honestly, how boring I think they are as a team. I mean, the Jaguars are right there with it. And what you think about Bortles as far as kind of looking the part of a quarterback, I don't think when you're in Jacksonville's position as a business franchise, picking someone like Bortles, who the most interesting thing about him is how hot his girlfriend is, is not a great sign. I mean, even what you think about Johnny Manziel in the next level is part of it, but certainly that the number three pick would have at least created more buzz. But I think the fact remains that nobody was too interested in selecting a quarterback. I think the Browns really proved that, because they selected Bortles at 3, so that was one quarterback off the board. The Browns clearly dearly wanted Manziel, but yet at the number 4 pick, they had no problem taking the Bills with the trade. to fall back a little bit, and even when they fell back, they still selected Justin Gilbert. So that it really feels like a miscalculation on the Jaguars' part. It's came out that they had Bortles pegged way early. It really feels like they just fell in love with him and couldn't see any other possibilities. I don't think Khalil Mack certainly would have been a hindrance to their team, and like everybody said, I mean, they could have went into the position where they, even if they select Khalil Mack at number three, and then, or if they were to trade it to the Bills, that would have been interesting how that would have panned out, where they had the pick at 8 or 9 and could have seen who they select then. I don't know. But it felt bad. And the rest of their draft, like I agree with you, Roger, the rest of their draft was good, which kind of makes the Bortles pick more of a head-scratcher. I think Marquise Lee possibly has a shot at being Offensive Rookie of the Year. I can see that. I think that kind of lives and die with Henny.
And I think that's the problem.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a scary proposition, but I can't foresee him being a bust. He just, to me, like, he looked like he could dominate any opposition he was up against, and USC faces tough competition in college, and he had to be pretty much manned or doubled, and a lot of stuff going on. He still put up some good stats. So I do think their draft kind of lives and dies with how good Bortles becomes. I was a little perplexed at some of the grading for them. Like, Mel Kiper gave them an A, which, regardless of what you think, I think that's kind of a head scratcher with the Bortles pick. So
he also gave the Browns a B-. So.
Yeah, poor Mel, but tough year for the hairspray for Mel, but. But yeah, I do think it just lives and dies with Bortles, what he becomes, and we won't know that probably. We certainly won't know it next year because they've already said Heaney's the quarterback, which again to me makes no sense. Like, I mean, I understand building for the future, but when you, I don't know. What do y'all guys think? Are you generally a fan of kind of throwing them to the wolves or not? I go back and forth, but with somebody like Heaney, I don't know how much of a mentor he can be for Bortles.
Yes. Exactly. I mean, generally, I think if you have a solid guy there, especially a guy like Bortles, if, you know, he's a little bit raw, it would probably help him to sit. But it's not as though he's Aaron Rodgers learning from Brett Favre. I mean, Chad Henne's, I think, pretty clearly the worst starting quarterback in the NFL. So what is Bortles going to learn other than how to be the worst starting quarterback in the NFL?
And if his issue is dealing with the pass rush and, you know, breaking down under pressure, is he going to learn that on the practice squad? You know what I mean?
That's true. Yeah.
Doesn't he need to see some NFL speed to start developing that skill, if it's even possible? I mean, well, have we ever seen a quarterback develop that skill that didn't start with it?
I think that their rationale is that they threw Gabbert to the wolves
and
too early.
Right.
I think he could have sat for 5 years and played, and he still would have been awful. I think the guy just, it was just a miscalculation of his talent. He came from a spread system that he's never going to be a good NFL quarterback. I mean, we'll see in San Francisco if anyone can turn him around. It's Harbaugh, but I just don't see it with that guy.
And with the way the financials work in the NFL right now, you know, you have a certain number of years with your quarterback on his rookie contract where, you know, he's worth, potentially, if he's good, he's worth way more than he's getting paid. And to waste one of those years on Chad Henne, I don't see the point. I don't see where you're going with Chad Henne. I mean, do you win one more game with him? I don't know. Is there any point to that?
Agreed.
Yeah, definitely agree.
All right, guys. Great first segment. First inaugural segment in the history of the PTBN Sports Lounge. I hope everyone's enjoying this as much as we are. So we'll be right back after these messages. We're going to talk some NBA draft. We'll be right back.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly from Ring of Honor Wrestling. Make sure you check out The Kevin Kelly Show each and every week. PlaceToBeNation.com. We'll be talking about wrestling in the past and wrestling today. Plus, be talking about all kinds of sports and pop culture, whatever's on your mind, too. We'll answer your questions each and every week. The Kevin Kelly Show, right here, PlaceToBeNation.com.
Let me know you in the house.
This is the king of old school, Steve Corino, and you've heard all the rumors, and it's true. The Steve Corino Show is here. We talk about wrestling. We talk about baseball, movies, television, anything you want to talk about. New guest every week. That's right. The Steve Corino Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
Hey, this is Bauer from The Bauer Show, sports and more. You can check out The Bauer Show podcast every Wednesday and Friday right here at PlaceToBeNation.com.
The Bauer Show.
Chad, do you hate it when commercials run and run?
What do you mean, Parv?
Oh, never mind.
Listen to Where the Big Boys Play on PlaceToBeNation.com and find us on iTunes. We are the only WCW Supercard exclusive podcast.
Hey, this is Rob Naylor. Do you still enjoy pro wrestling? Believe it or not, I still do. So you better join myself and Will on the Google Wrestling Podcast exclusively at PlaceToBeNation.com.
Shit, I wasn't ready. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening and... Shit. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening to guys talk about old school wrestling, follow me and Charles on Wrestling with the Past podcast on Place to Be Nation.
So you got the script, yeah? You all got it?
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds terrible. The Titans of Wrestling... Oh, brilliant. Sorry. The Titans of Wrestling are...
Pete, I'm a lead analyst for a show at Breakdown Matches.
Kelly, lead historian. I'm a jobber lover. Are you?
Johnny and I drink.
And yes, me, Parv. We watch old school wrestling and love it.
Titans of Wrestling. You know you want to hear it.
That's right.
Welcome back to the Place to Be Nation Sports Lounge. Hope everyone's ready for some NBA draft talk. So, a couple days ago we had the lottery. It's a hopeful time for many a franchise. But it's only a good time, generally, for the Cleveland Cavaliers, who somehow, with a 1% chance of winning the pick, won the first pick again. And there's been a lot of talk about, are we rewarding just horrible ineptitude in that, you know, Cleveland actually tried to win this year. They brought in Spencer Hawes, amongst others. They felt like a playoff team.
How did that not work?
And Luol Deng. And Luol Deng was a fantastic player. And, you know, Cleveland tries to win. They still suck. And then they get lucky again and win the first pick in the draft. So the other teams in the league are not happy about that. But Cleveland gets another chance here. So they've picked in the top five a number of the last few years. They came away with a Kyrie Irving. Good pick. Agreed, Andy? Good pick?
Yeah, solid.
Yeah, and that's about it for the good ones. So Tristan Thompson at number four looks like he could be...
Great pick. Great pick.
Could be a serviceable big man at best.
Yeah.
Deion Waiters at four looks like an absolute stiff whiff. At best, he's Vinny the Microwave Johnson. Pretty good scorer off the bench, but does absolutely nothing else. Andy's a cancer in the locker room, so...
I won't have you selling the good name of Vinny Microwave Johnson.
But the Microwave was a nice player. Was he worth the fourth overall pick in
Probably
the draft?
Probably not.
And you know what maybe should have tipped them off about Waiters was that he didn't even start for Syracuse. So why would you pick him fourth overall?
Yeah, that seemed odd at the time. It has not really gotten better.
And then they capped that off with last year's, shall we say, just utter disaster so far with Anthony Bennett, number one overall. He was considered a reach at the time. I actually... Watching him in college, I thought it was a pretty good pick. I thought he was it was a draft devoid of stars. I like the Oladipo, but I thought Bennett, he had a bunch of upside, but I didn't take into account that he was going to Cleveland. And by going to Cleveland, it seems to have sunk him. He spent some of the time injured when he did play. I mean, for the first half of the season, he was probably the worst regular in the whole NBA. He did step it up a bit in the second half, so he does have some potential there. But that's what led us to the draft, the lottery a couple days ago, where Cleveland wins the first pick again. So let's open this up. If you're Cleveland, you're picking first again. Everybody thinks you whiffed last year, and you gambled last year. You took a guy that no one else really would have taken number one. So if I'm Cleveland, I'm probably going to go with the chalk, and I'm probably going to take Wiggins. Seems to be the consensus number one overall. I wasn't that impressed with what I saw from him at Kansas, but he's got the measurables. He's gonna develop, I think, at worst into a 15-7 kind of guy. I think that's his floor, and he does have a very high ceiling with his athletic ability. Andy, what would you do with that number one pick if you were the Cavs?
Yeah, it's tough. At this point, like you said, you got burned so badly with Anthony Bennett, who has conditioning problems, asthma. You know, really could not have gone worse his rookie year. I feel like if it was, if we put the team aside, I feel like Embiid is the best pick. He has the highest ceiling of any of those, three guys at the top. He's a 7-foot guy, incredible athlete. He has good shooting range. Hasn't played the game forever. Only like 4 years, I believe it is. He has plenty of room to grow and turn into something good, but on the other hand, he has back trouble, and he's a little raw. And I don't know if Cleveland can survive whiffing on another number one pick. I think the city might just burn to the ground. I think the safest guy, I think, is Parker. He has the most NBA-ready skill set. He can come in right away. He's a Paul Pierce type. He can help them maybe get back to the first round of the playoffs. Probably not much farther, but it really depends on your tolerance for risk at this point. If you want the safe thing, you're going to have to go with Parker. Chad?
I agree with that. It's so tough because it is the Cavaliers as the number one pick. So I do think with what happened last year, they do have to be pretty cautious. So that's why if I was just starting my team and I was given the first pick myself for the for the Chadley Oakleys, I would go with Embiid number one, just for overall size potential and everything Andy said. But if I did think if I could put on my hat as the Cleveland Cavaliers, I actually think I would pick Jabari Parker. At Duke, he seemed to be very NBA ready, ready to start. I think he would work well with Kyrie Irving. They could have the Duke vibe going there and would work well on that team and kind of help them rise above the ranks there. And maybe you get something out of Bennett, hopefully, or Waiters or some of these other guys.
Well, I think that's the concern, right? Do Waiters and Parker have a similar role on the team? Like, what are you doing there? He doesn't have much trade value at this point.
So my concern, the reason I wouldn't take Parker is that I think Deng is probably the best player, the safest guy on the team. He's probably the most, he's a winner. And he's a pure small forward, right? And Parker is a pure small forward. I don't know if Parker can play the two. I don't know if he's quick enough to guard twos on the defensive end. I don't think being in, the fact that Waiters is a two, I don't think matters at all because he's destined to just be a, you bring him in off the bench. If he's hot, you leave him in. If not, you just take him out. That's his career arc, in my opinion. But I think Wiggins offers the most amount of upside, and I think that even if he's not great his rookie season, that because he's kind of the consensus guy there and because of the upside, I think that he would I think they would give him room to develop. Plus, I think he can play the two due to his athletic ability. He's more athletic than Parker. So if they would not have traded for Deng, and they probably shouldn't have traded for Deng,
no.
Given the state of their team, they basically traded for Deng looking to slide into the number 8 seed and get swept in the first round of the playoffs.
And then they wouldn't have
gotten the number 1 pick. But I think it's a tough to take Parker there with Deng in the fold, and then tough to not re-sign Deng after what they gave up for him.
Yeah, I think they miscalculated last year just thinking that Kyrie Irving, who I think is good, but I think perhaps they had visions of him going on maybe like a Derrick Rose type year or something like that, really making the jump to be one of the 5 to 10 best players in the league. And that, and while I thought he was fine this year, that didn't happen. And then around him with the Bennett pick and everything else, most of their moves seem to flounder. So I do think this number 1 pick overall for them is a good chance at redemption. They need to bounce back. If you look at their roster currently, they seem to have certain pieces that would work. I mean, with Irvin, maybe with what Tristan Thompson can give you from here on out, with Ding there, and even someone like Jared Jack in a complimentary role. They need to score big on this pick.
Varejao is also a nice piece.
How old is he?
32, I believe.
But he's got miles on him, though. He's kind of an old 32.
He is. But he's the kind of guy that could...
He is only 32.
If they do make the playoffs, he's the kind of guy you want on your team in the playoffs. He's also the kind of guy who's completely wasted on a terrible team.
He never seemed to stay healthy either. That's part of the problem.
Yeah, that's part of it. Also, maybe the ugliest man in the NBA, so he has that form as well.
It's a strong statement, Chad.
It is true.
There are some ugly guys in the NBA. All right, so next up, we had the team with the worst record in the league this year. The Milwaukee Bucks drew the second pick. Bucks are an interesting case in that, again, they were a team that went out and signed some free agents last year, signed O.J. Mayo, for example. They were looking to win, and the rails just came off early, highlighted by, I don't know if you guys have seen the video of Larry Sanders fighting in the strip club, but where he hurt his hand, I believe. It's one of the funnier things I've ever seen in my life.
We should do a live watch of that.
But the rails came off, and I think, you know, for them, it was actually that they're better off, you know, bottoming out like they did, then just getting killed in the playoffs again. So I think they're in a good spot at 2. And assuming, you know, it's tough to assume who's going to go 1, but assuming Embiid doesn't go 1, I think he's a good pick for them there. Mm-hmm. I think with say what you want about Sanders, but he is a pretty good player when he's a
if he can get his head straight
when he's got his head straight. And they have the Greek Freak, looks like he's going to be a, I've never seen a guy like him. He's like, looks like he's like 7'2" playing small forward, just a string bean. He looks like Gumby. And they have some pieces there, but I think they probably know now that they're a couple years away. And Embiid, I think, has Hakeem Olajuwon type of upside. I mean, he is a, before he got hurt this year, I mean, he is a beast. He could really, really develop into something good. I mean, maybe even, you know, I think a floor for him could be, you know, older Mutombo, but I mean, but I mean, I think he could be, or Ibaka. Yeah, a little bit of a different guy. He's bigger than Ibaka, but I mean, there's not a lot of true centers in the league now. And I mean, he is so athletic. He's so athletic, and he's just developed so much over such a short period of time that I don't think the Cavs are going to take Embiid, and I think it's a coup for the Bucks to get him at 2. Well, what do you think there, Andy?
Well, you brought up the idea of the Greek Freak and Sanders and Embiid all playing together. That's a pretty terrifying defensive unit, just those three guys. I mean, I don't even care who's playing the guard spots at that point. There's a lot of potential there. On the other hand, you know, they could use talent at pretty much every position. You know, they were just a mess. They were a disaster. And Like I said, I'd take Embiid 1 if you put all other concerns aside, and I just had to say who was the one player I'd want out of this draft. So I think that would be great if he fell to them.
Yeah, this seems like a slam dunk to me for Embiid to go here. They also have my boy Zaza Pachulia, who
you are such a homer.
It's someone that for years had to see Zaza barreling down the lane and then throwing up a shot as he tripped over his own 2 feet and called for a foul.
While intentionally elbowing somebody in the face.
The dirtiest
player in the whole NBA.
but seeing that offensive prowess, having somebody like Embiid in the center position that can score, has swifty moves, looks like a very good addition to their roster, and then they can build around him for years to come.
Absolutely. Picking third were the Sixers, who were terrible, but weren't quite as terrible as everyone thought they were going to be.
Yeah.
Started off hot, and then, I mean, they basically intentionally lost about 25 games in a row in the second half of the season, and then I think it was the right move. I think they're going to take – they kind of have to take – it's a four-person draft, right? Top four are pretty much set in stone, Wiggins, Embiid, Parker, and Dante Exum. They're not taking Exum with Michael Carter-Williams, obviously. That's they're similar guys, and there's Carter-Williams looked great his rookie season. You know, I have some concerns about him, but he reminds me a lot of I'm a Celtics fan, but he reminds me a lot of Rondo in that he's really good at everything, but can't shoot his way out of a paper bag. But it's overall he's their best player, but I think they got to take whoever falls, Wiggins or Parker. So in my draft, it would be Parker. I think Wiggins is a better fit for them, given that they probably wouldn't mind being in the top three again next year. I mean, they traded away every veteran guy they had, Hawes, Turner. They didn't trade Thaddeus Young, but I think they would have, and they might this year. But if Wiggins is there, I think the upside is great. But if not, Parker's a good consolation prize. The problem is Parker's going to help them win more games this year, which I don't think they want to do. Andy?
I think they're aware that Wiggins is a better fit here. Just for his defensive ability alone, he could really help that team out a lot on that end, which was a big problem for them last year. Would they be better off with Parker? I don't think so. But I'm sure they'd be happy with either one. I think they're both going to be contributors pretty early on.
Yeah, it would be a big upset if those three people weren't at least the top three picks, really, even though it does seem like Exum is number four in that quartet. He seems clearly the number four guy there. The Philadelphia 76ers were a fun case this season because Brad Woodling was so excited when they went right out of the gate, like 2-1. And then we didn't hear anything about them after that until like May.
They beat the Heat and the Heat and the Bulls back-to-back to start the season?
Yeah.
He was so giddy. Like, I hadn't heard a word from him about basketball, and all of a sudden he's like fully behind the Carter Williams bandwagon, and then nothing. But yeah, I think it certainly seems very easy that they'll pick either Parker or Wiggins, whoever's left there.
Yeah, and you're talking about a good core there with either one of those guys, with Michael Carter Williams and Noel. That was a fantastic trade they made.
I like that trade.
Great, great trade they made last year. I don't know if it's such as much a good trade from them or just a god awful move for the Hornets. But yeah. All right. Next up, the Magic. I watched a lot of Magic games, and I think they got some upside. I think they're not as bad as their record. I think picking fourth, they kind of have to take Exum, even though I think him and Oladipo kind of cancel each other out. But Oladipo is such a Swiss Army knife that I think he can fit in with anybody. And I think having two like 6'6" guys in the backcourt that can both handle the ball and both play good defense, I think they have to take Exum. A guy I really like who kind of fell at this year, and who, if it were me drafting, I might take this guy because I don't think Orlando's that far away with Vucevic, and Tobias Harris is a really good player, and Oladipo. I might take Julius Randle here. I think he's a 2010 guy for the next 10 years. He doesn't have quite the upside of some of these other guys, but I think he can step in right away and be a really solid four. So if the Cowboy was the GM for the Magic, I'm taking Randall and, you know, rolling the dice there, because if it doesn't work out, they're gonna run me out of town. But I think they'll probably take Exum, but I would take Randall. Andy?
Yeah, it's this is where Marcus Smart really cost himself a lot of money this year, because I think Orlando clearly needs a point guard, but there's not really someone who fits the number four pick, which is unfortunate. I mean, there's Exum, obviously, but he's not quite the playmaker that they could use. But, you know, he could fit in good next to Oladipo. And I'm not so sure about Randall. I do think he's going to, you know, he has an NBA-ready talent set, you know what I mean? But I don't think he's a star. And then again, this is the fourth pick. I mean, are you getting a franchise changing player at this point? I don't know. I guess I'd probably go with Exum if it was me.
I think I'd go with Randall. If you look at their roster, it's an interesting roster, because I doubt, Roger, you said you watched a lot of them, but I don't think a lot of people kind of realize, like, Tobias Harris is a guy that I don't think many even casual NBA fans would know who he is. But, I mean, he was solid. Like, he averaged, I think, around almost 15 points per game. Always seemed to be pretty productive when I watched him. And then they seem to have certain pieces. And I think there are only a couple players or small moves away from at least flirting with that 6-7 kind of Atlanta Hawks territory right now, maybe even where the Washington Wizards are at currently, kind of that type of ceiling in the Eastern Conference. So I think Randall would benefit well, and then they could have a pretty solid six-man rotation.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, they had Big Baby Davis as their four, and he just flamed out in a big way last year. Tobias Harris is really he's kind of a combo 3-4, so he's a, you know, he's a big three, or like more of a stretch four, real athletic kid. He can knock down threes. I mean, he had a number of games. I mean, if you look at his game log, I mean, 26-12, 20-17. I mean, he's going to be a good player. But I think a guy like Randall, put him next to Vucevic, is really, really good too. And he was hurt a lot of last year, but he is really, really good. So, you know, again, I guess it depends on whether they going to be in win now mode, because the East is so bad that it doesn't take much to go from second to last in the East to seventh. Like the Bobcats showed this year. The Bobcats are the laughingstock of the NBA year after year after year. They add Al Jefferson, and now they're in the playoffs because they're in the Eastern Conference. And as the Magic, are they, you know, do they want to be a playoff team now, or are they still just stockpiling assets for the future? Because Exum's obviously the high upside pick. Not that anyone here, I'm sure, has ever seen him play, you know, but, you know, I mean, 6'6 point guard, I don't know. To see a guy, I think Randall's getting devalued, which happens, and I think it's a measurable upside thing, but...
When I went on my recruiting trip down to Australia in preparation for this podcast, I was able to watch a lot of Exum live.
Excellent, Chad. Chaddy Oakley on the trail of Dante Exum on the Outback. wearing his hat, Crocodile Dundee style. Next up, we have the Jazz, the poor Jazz. What a fall from grace. I mean, I spent some time in Arizona, and so I know a number of people from Utah, and they are, you know, these are the most passionate fans in the country. They have nothing else going on. It's all Jazz all the time. I mean, I had more arguments. You know, they're vehemently defending Deron Williams as the best point guard in the
NBA.
Those
days, yeah.
Better than Chris Paul. And, you know, and even just a couple of years ago, I mean, they had Al Jefferson, they had Millsap. They were a good team, and they decided to blow it up. And that's fine. And they drafted Trey Burke last year, who, you know, it wasn't a great draft, but he could be he's very low upside, but he could be a 15-7 point guard. But they just really weren't quite bad enough this year. They needed a higher pick than this. They needed to be in that top three, and it really, really hurts them to not be in the top three. Given where they're picking, again, if Randall's there, I think he's the pick. If for some reason he wasn't there, I don't know if they would take Exum because they have Trey Burke, but Randall's going to help him now. The Jazz fans, it's a different kind of franchise in that I don't think that they're not prepared to go through a 5-6 year rebuild. It's you know, they're used to Stockton and Malone for 20 years in a row making the playoffs. And I don't think, you know, the roster is just so devoid of talent right now that I think you have to take the best talent on the board who can help you right now. And I think that would be Randall. Andy?
Yeah, I agree. I don't think Randall should fall any farther than this. It's unfortunate because, you know, power forward's not really a position to need for them. But, you know, you can only draft for need so much. You kind of have to take the best guy available. And, you know, I don't know much about Noah Vonleh, is that how you pronounce it?
I believe
so. But I think Julius Randle's the best player available at this point.
Yeah, I mean, their best player now, the Jazz, is Gordon Hayward, who, I mean, and he's looking for max money, and I don't know if Gordon Hayward's worth max money, but they have to give it to him.
He's an interesting test case for who's the worst player worth max money. We'll find out, I guess.
I mean, he fits right in for Utah for a number of different reasons.
For a number? Or just that one?
What do you think, Chad? Chaddy Oakley?
It'd be tough for them to draft a power forward because they have Marvin Williams there already. I mean, that's such a great player.
Such a key asset. Tongue in cheek. That would be that was as if the Jacksonville Jaguars made that pick when he went before Chris Paul and Deron Williams.
Please don't remind me when y'all were talking about Deion Waiters not starting at Syracuse. I had terrible memories of sixth man Marvin Williams on the championship team being sixth on his own team in North Carolina, but apparently number two in the hearts of Atlanta Hawks fans and executives.
At least the Hawks, you know, needed a point guard and already had like three small forwards on that team too.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it was one of those, you know, they drafted for not for talent or need.
I digress. they definitely will draft, I think, a power forward. I think it'd be pretty dumb, honestly, if they didn't draft Randall, if he's still available. If not, they have a baby of other power forwards kind of hanging around there between Volley, Aaron Gordon from Arizona, who I did watch a good bit of. I did watch a lot of Arizona, which seemed like a team that was kind of I don't know if, Roger, you watched a lot of them being in Arizona, kind of a little bit resident Arizona knowledge. But Arizona this year as college felt like a team that really worked together as a team. I don't know how well individually everybody worked. It seemed like they worked better within the scheme. And then this random Dario Saric from Croatia, who is another person I haven't been able to fly across the country to watch a lot of yet. But I think they have to draft power forward because they got nobody right now, really.
Absolutely. So we looked at the top five, and I think that, I think that's a good start. And we're going to certainly dive deeper into this in future episodes. But I thought, you know, given that the lottery was so recent, and there was such a surprise at the beginning, I thought taking a deep dive into the top five made a lot of sense. Kind of want to pivot here and talk about the big news in the NBA and get you guys' thoughts on Mr. Kevin Love. So as I'm sure most everyone's aware, Kevin Love has made it clear he wants out of Minnesota. He's got 1 year left on his deal. They have to trade him, even though the GM says we're not going to trade him. Obviously, that's posturing. The guy's not, if you know, a player of that caliber is not going to re-sign. You have to get something for him, so they're going to trade him. I was curious you guys' thoughts on where you think the most likely destination is, where you think he's the best fit, and kind of what you think of him as a player in that big numbers, but not a lot of success, kind of similar to a Kyrie Irving in that, you know, he puts up great numbers for terrible teams. So, again, we'll kick it to Chad first. Where do you think Love's the best fit? Where do you think he's going to go? What do you think of him in general?
So I'm a big Love guy in general. I do think it is tough because he has been on perpetually bad teams, and we don't know how he will perform if he's kind of one piece, if he's someone that is one piece away from hopefully contending. I think that's where any of his possible destinations is hoping that they'll at least be able to get some spark, kind of like how Houston had visions of this year when they got Howard, and then last year when they got Harden. But if he is going to be traded, I think it becomes more complicated with who has assets to trade for Minnesota. I can see Minnesota just sitting tight if they don't get the trade value they hope for, but I do think they probably need to move him and at least get something back in return if they don't make a move in the offseason by worst at the trade deadline. So I think the Bulls certainly will make a run, but I don't know if they'll have the pieces. Apparently the Celtics, I guess y'all could talk about this better since y'all are in Celtics land, but I've heard rumblings of them. And then I guess the Lakers always want to make a move for somebody like this, so they're kind of lingering back there. But I don't know. I mean, I think it'd be interesting to see which piece would work for them. I think Cleveland now has to be considered in the conversation now that they have the number one pick somehow in their back pocket. And Love, if he was paired with someone like Kyrie Irving, would be very interesting to see what that team could produce if they traded the number one overall pick and you know, like a Tristan Thompson and a couple other pieces. I don't think that would be a terrible return for Minnesota, all things considered. So they may actually be kind of my front runners right now.
All right. So my issue with the Cleveland being the front runners is they can certainly offer the most, but the big thing for whoever trades for Love is, you don't want it to be a 1 year rental, right?
Right.
You need to know that he's going to sign.
Yeah.
And going from Minnesota to Cleveland, I don't know if he would be a guarantee to sign an extension in Cleveland. And I mean, it would be very Cleveland like for them to give up the number one pick in the most loaded draft of the last 10 years.
Sure, absolutely.
Grab Kevin Love and then have him leave just like LeBron did. Maybe Kevin Love wouldn't do it on an ESPN special, but that would, you know, that would be something that Cleveland would do. But personally, I think the Celtics, this might be coming from my heart a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think the Celtics are a good destination. They have Rondo. They have an all-star. Adding Love to the mix, I don't think makes them championship worthy, but I think at the very least gets them into the playoffs. But knowing Ainge, there would be something else behind that, either a free agent or another trade. And I think that, you know, we could, or the Celtics could convince Love to sign an extension too. Just, you know, playing in Boston, the history there, the fans. I think we would we would embrace Kevin Love here in the Northeast. What do you think, Andy?
Yeah, it's hard for me to tell. You know, living in New England, it's hard for me to tell how much of this is just homerism and wishful thinking, because everyone seems to be just assuming that Kevin Love's going to end up here. And, you know, looking at it from Minnesota's perspective, I don't know how valuable that number six pick is. Like, you know, we just went through our little mock draft of the top five, and we're already kind of getting lukewarm after we got past the first four or five guys. You know, that six pick isn't going to put you back on the path to the playoffs. So I understand this perspective that they have to get something. They can't let him leave for nothing, like what happened to Cleveland with LeBron. But on the other hand, you know, Oklahoma City got essentially nothing for James Harden, and it's been a big problem for them. So it's...
Like, likely, who would they trade? Like a Brandon Bass and the number six?
Brandon Bass isn't worth... pay another team to take Brandon Bass. Jared Solinger.
Okay, Solinger in the six.
Solinger, the number six pick, and some future assets.
Does Olenek have any value at this point?
Jared Wallace's corpse.
Yes.
No one wants him. I mean, he's overpaid too, Chad. Olenek was second team... all rookie.
Olenek was okay. Also a contender for the ugliest guy in the NBA.
But I mean, I'm in the camp that I don't think it's going to take that much to get him, because there's such a short list of teams that he's going to be willing to go to that will know that they can sign him. I mean, he had mentioned Golden State and Chicago, and the package the Celtics can put together is better than what Golden State or Chicago can put together. Mm-hmm. He obviously wants to win now, though. So I think if the Lakers are another team that could put a similar package together to the Celtics, and
well,
then,
other than that number six pick,
well, they have the seven.
Okay. I was way off. I'm sorry.
the Lakers have the seventh pick, and I think that would be a destination that Love could look at and talk himself into. Yeah, we could contend for a championship with Kobe, Gasol, and Love. It's a pretty good three-headed monster if Kobe can stay healthy. Plus, he's an LA kid. He went to UCLA. So it's real interesting, though. It's not every year that, you know, guy who can consistently put up 24 and 12 is available. And I think it's... it's awesome. I love it.
Well, I think the thing with the Lakers is, I mean, Love, he does seem to have a win now mentality. And while Kevin Love is not a spring chicken, though, he still seems to have a lot kind of left in the tank. And if he did go to the Lakers, it's possible they could contend right away with Kobe and Paul, but... man, it feels like they would have to. I mean, Kobe. Oof, I don't know.
One
how
year.
Much.
I mean, Love's Love's only 25. Love came out of UCLA after one year.
Yeah, he only had the 1 year when they went to the Final Four. So
right, and I think, you know, if he's looking long term, he could say, you know, maybe we can contend with Kobe and Gasol, but then the next year,
you
get a guy like Russell Westbrook's going to be a free agent.
Somebody, yeah.
And that's his college, you know, that's UCLA, and Russell Westbrook and Kevin Love on the same team is a contender right away. Top 10 team in the league for sure. So, you know, there could be a wink-wink where these guys... kind of like what Bosh and Wade and James did, where these guys kind of say, okay, well, if I go here, you think maybe you'll go here? So real interesting stuff, and I can't wait to see how it plays out. We could have movement on this even before our next show, and we can discuss it more then. So that's going to end segment two. Coming up, we're going to be talking some MMA, big pay-per-view, and also some Major League Baseball as we look at the AL East. So thanks, guys. That was a great NBA talk there. And over and out for now. Pickpockets paying the debt. I'm caught a bullet in the lung from Bernie Hawkins. Overworking underpaid, staring at the floor. Prostitutes, spandex, caught in the sliding door. What's going on? This is the Godfather, Nate Milton, with an offer you cannot refuse. Each and every week, you can join Marcus Vanderberg,
Big Nasty Alfred Kunawa, and myself on the Kings of Sport podcast, available exclusively on placetobenation.com, your one-stop spot for the best in sports and pop culture.
Hey, this is Ben Morse from Marvel.com as well as the Brad and Chad Show, and I've got a new podcast. Well, I'm part of a new podcast, Place to Be Nation's Main Event. Hosted by Scott Criscolo every other week, it's a roundtable discussion with myself, Andrew Reich, Steve Willey, Jordan Duncan, and an assortment of special guests as we talk wrestling today, the big questions, and our feelings. Please, please, please check this podcast out, because if the ratings go down, I know I'm the first head on the chopping block for Justin Rosero. See you guys every other week on Place to Be Nation's Main Event.
I'm Scott Criscolo, and your new home for sports is Place to Be Nation's Extra Point. Join me and the doctor, George Urbelino, for your sports hookup, whether it's NFL, Major League Baseball, NBA, colleges, or the Cowboys MMA Blitz.
Forget about it. Plus, join me for my prescription where I will solve all the world's sports problems with my own brand of medicine.
That's Place to Be Nation's Extra Point here on PlaceToBeNation.com.
In Rhode Island and looking for great food and a fun atmosphere, we'll be sure to stop by Bonehead's Wing Bar, 131 Washington Street in West Warwick, with over 65 different wing sauces and dozens of sandwiches, burgers, and appetizers, and a fully stocked bar. Bonehead's has something for everyone. Bonehead's also shows every WWE and UFC pay-per-view, features live music, weekly trivia, and much, much more. So, be sure to stop in, tell Matt and the crew that Place to Be Nation sent you, and become a Bonehead today.
Welcome back to the Place to Be Nation Sports Lounge. This is your host, the Cowboy, Roger Morissette. Now, we have a special treat for you for our inaugural episode this afternoon. I have a baseball expert with me, MLB expert, who's going to be joining the show on a periodic basis. His name is Keith Schmidt. Keith is a dear friend and also a huge Red Sox fan, and we are actually going to be discussing the AL East today. So the way this is going to work is that once an episode, we're going to go and do a deep dive on one of the divisions in the major leagues. We decided to start with the AL East. It has nothing to do with our allegiance to the Red Sox, but we feel like we can talk very intelligently about the Red Sox, and I know Keith can. So how are you doing, Keith?
I'm all right, Raj. Cowboy.
Cowboy's right. So, speaking of the AL East, and again, not due to this being the home team, but the real story in the AL East right now is the Red Sox. As of taping, they are on a 10-game losing streak. You're defending World Series champs on a 10-game losing streak. Never good. And what do you think's going on with the Sox, Keith? Why, do you think they can right the ship? What do you think the problems are?
They can't pitch. They can't hit. There you go, in a nutshell. Now, you got Clay Buchholz. Last year looked like a Cy Young winner when he was healthy. Now he looks like a Triple-A pitcher. The lineup. No more Ellsbury. No leadoff hitter. Bottom line. They cannot get anything started. Can't get people on base, you can't drive anybody in.
Agreed. Buchholz has been absolutely terrible. And he's actually pitching today. We'll see if he can get things turned around. It almost seems like he might have he might have an injury or something, or he's always been a little bit of a head case. Maybe there's something mentally there, because I mean, the guy was like you said, Keith, maybe the best pitcher in the American League when he was healthy last year, and now he's probably the worst starting pitcher in the American League who hasn't gotten pulled from the rotation yet.
He's close to it, that's for sure. And I think a lot of it is mental with him. His velocity was up his last stop, 93-94, which is where he was at last year when he was dominating. So we'll see if he can turn it around. I mean, he's got a National League lineup today, so Hopefully he can right the ship for the Red Sox, eh?
Absolutely. And, you know, sometimes with the Interleague, these guys haven't seen him before. That could be a positive for him. You know, you see sometimes pitchers that struggle against their own league can pitch a little better in Interleague because the hitters aren't used to them. You know, looking at the rest of the Red Sox rotation, I mean, really, Lester has been very solid. Do you agree with that?
Ace. Yep. Ace in the making. Lackey's been solid. PV up and down, but for number three, he's doing his job. Felix Dubront is the other worry. I think he's on a short leash. They've got a few arms in the minors. Brandon Workman, who pitched yesterday, he pitched okay. You got Alan Webster, who's ready. You got Ruby De La Rosa, who could be coming up. Anthony Renato. So the future looks bright. Hopefully these guys can keep doing what they're doing in AAA and help the team down the line.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just the rails seem to really have come off here recently. Now, the ironic thing is that even with this horrible stretch that the Red Sox have gone through, due to the rest of the division, I don't know whether it's just a really good division and they're beating up on each other, or you have a bunch of mediocrity in the division. But even after a 10-game losing streak, the Sox are in last place, but they're only 8 games back in May, which is not an insurmountable lead. On the hitting side, Ortiz has been great, right? And other than him, though, I'm pretty disappointed in some of the younger guys, particularly Middlebrooks. And, you know, I hate to say I'm disappointed in Bogarts because he's such a spring chicken, such a young guy. But I was expecting a little bit more out of him. And then, you know, a guy like Grady Sizemore, who, you know, we both know before he was injured is, you know, top 10 outfielder in the major leagues. Yes, you know, now supposedly he's healthy, but he just seems to not have it anymore. Pedroia has been steady. You got to think he'll obviously bat higher, I think, than .267 for the season. So he's gonna turn things around.
The law of averages says he'll be up near 300, which means he's got a hot streak coming real soon. Grady Sizemore, he hasn't played in 2 years. You can't jump back in and play with the big boys after 2 years and expect to produce right away. His leash is getting short. Daniel Nava just came back up from Pawtucket. Grady doesn't... He goes on another 0-for-12 slump. You might see him cut.
Right, that's a great point. Two years off, 2 years not seeing major league pitching. It's not easy. Not easy to come back.
Not at all.
So, in a word or two, Keith, do you think the Sox can turn it around? Do you think they're going to turn it around?
I think there's still 115 games left in the season. You will see some up and downs, but they will not finish in last place in this division.
All right. You heard it here first. The Sox are not going to finish in last place. And as a Sox fan, I hope you're right there, Keith. All right, now, going from the bottom of the division to the top, you know, we got to have a bit of a surprise team on top, maybe doing it a year later. So the Toronto Blue Jays sit with a 2-game lead as of right now. They're on a 6-game winning streak. And is it me, Keith, or was it last year that they were supposed to really turn the corner? They went out and signed all these guys and then just completely flopped. Do you think this is just kind of like a delayed reaction to that? Or what are you attributing to the Blue Jays' hot start here?
Well, first of all, health. Their lineup is intact right now. They went and basically raped the Miami Marlins last year for Reyes and Burley. And now those guys are... Mark Burley, what is 8-1? Are you kidding me? Where did that come from? You got R.A. Dickey, who they got from the Mets. Well, they signed him last year. Who's pitching more like R.A. Dickey and not Tim Wakefield. Drew Hutchinson, who's been a surprise addition. But when you talk Toronto, you got to talk about the lineup. It is murderer's row. They got 5 guys in that lineup that can hit 30 home runs. Lowry, Encarnacion, Batista, Adam Lind, Juan Francisco, Colby Rasmus. There's 6. I mean, there's no easy out in that lineup. And Jose Reyes at the top.
Yeah. probably for my money, he's probably the best leadoff man in the game when he's healthy with his combination power, speed. Great player. He does have trouble staying healthy. To your point, they've been pretty fortunate with injuries so far, and you know Batista and Reyes in particular have had significant injury problems.
Yes.
That pitching staff to me is I can't imagine. I think Mark Burley is what he is, and he's gone through stretches like this before. I wouldn't exactly be buying Mark Burley stock at the current price. If you know what I mean. I mean, there's got to be some regression there. Dickey, on the other hand, I think, especially over the last month and a half or so, has really started to show some of that form he had with the Mets during his Cy Young winning effort. With him, they talk about the velocity of the knuckleball, right? The faster he's throwing that knuckleball, it seems like the better he is, and he's regained that velocity, and his ERA has been stellar over the last 6 weeks. So.
Yes, he has. And the transition from coming from the National League to the American League, it was a rude awakening for him last year.
Right.
And now he's adjusting to the lineups. He's pitching a lot better.
Absolutely, especially as we've seen that the Mets Park there, the Citi Field, just what a pitcher's paradise it is. We really didn't know that at the time, but it is. You know, David Wright might not hit 10 home runs in a season again for the rest of his the rest of his career. But you know, what do you think, Keith? Do you think they can stay on top? Personally, I think this is a third place team. I think for them to stay on top, there's just too much that has to go right there. Their pitching has to continue to be good, which I'm not convinced that it's good. And those guys all have to stay healthy. What do you think?
The health, number one. Number two, they need to make a deal. They need to get an ace. Because although Dickey is pitching like an ace right now, he's more a number two. There is a guy in Chicago, his name's Jeff Samardzija, who will be traded at the deadline. Where he goes, who knows?
Yeah, Samardzija would certainly be a great fit for Toronto, and if he has ace stuff, that's for sure. He's a little bit inconsistent, but he's better than anybody they have, and I think by quite a bit. And I think with him, Dickey, and Burley at the top of the rotation, they could hold on to first place, and that would be a scary team to play in the playoffs too.
Absolutely.
Without those having to face those bottom two guys.
Absolutely, and the lineup. I mean, you know, you don't have to pitch like Felix Hernandez to win when you have that lineup behind you. You can give up 3-4 runs and still win.
Right, absolutely. And a guy like Encarnacion, everyone was a little worried about him at the beginning of the year, but he is he might be the best pure power hitter in the game right now.
He is fantastic. And that goes back to the law of averages. Yep. In April, he hit one home run. How many has he got now?
Right.
14?
Just about 14, right, Keith? Let's see. 14.
There you go.
Next up, we have New York Yankees. Again, you're going to get an unbiased analysis here on the Sports Lounge. Again, where we are, we're not huge fans of the Yankees, but we can certainly take a look at them. Two games back, I think the real story for them has been Tanaka. He is. You know, you never know with these imports, because I mean, especially the Yankees have not had great success, right? A guy like Arabu, for example,
yes.
And Tanaka, he's the real deal. He's an ace right now.
Yes, he
he's,
is.
What do you think of Tanaka? You don't think it's smoke and mirrors?
No, not at all. He's more Hugh Darvish than Daisuke Matsuzaka.
Right,
that is for sure. He's got. Four pitches. He can throw them all for strikes. Good velocity.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Fantastic pitcher.
Yeah, and he knows how to pitch, too. And that splitter, you get two strikes on you.
You're
against
done.
Him, it's pretty much a game, set, match. And it just goes to show, I mean, because this is a team that has a lot of holes. And coming into the season, maybe didn't look like world beaters. But it goes to show you how adding that one top-of-the-rotation arm can make everything else come together. Now you get, you know, Kuroda. Kuroda's goes from being a de facto ace that he really isn't to now he's a solid number two.
Right, he can slide into where he's comfortable in the number two spot. But the other thing with the Yankees, Robinson Cano, he got $250 million, was it, in Seattle?
It was.
So instead they signed Jacoby Ellsbury, Brian McCann, Carlos Beltran, and Tanaka.
Makes a whole lot of sense, doesn't it?
Instead of getting one player who gets up four times a game, they got five. An ace pitcher, a great leadoff hitter, who, in my opinion, is the best leadoff hitter in the game when healthy. Yeah. Carlos Beltran, plenty of experience, power hitter, especially with that short porch, forget it. Brian McCann, a leader, good hitter, maybe not average-wise, but got a lot of power.
And one of my concerns for the Yanks coming into the season was the age and health of their infield. Teixeira, Brian Roberts, Jeter.
And who's playing third base?
Is it Kelly Johnson.
Hmm.
It was Kelly Johnson. But so that was one of our concerns coming into the season, right? Was these guys, there's no way in hell they're all going to stay healthy.
No, they're too old.
No, but you have a guy like Yenjirvis Solarte come up.
Where did he come from?
Yeah, I mean, this guy's hitting better in the major leagues than he was than he has ever in the minor leagues, and I'm sure there's going to be some regression there. But he's filling a giant hole for them in that.
Yes, he
now
is.
He's providing. I mean, he's the everyday third baseman now, but he's providing depth for that infield too.
Yes.
That when Roberts goes down, when Teixeira misses a few games, when the captain misses a few games, they don't just have Kelly Johnson now. They have another guy that can slide around, and he's been a godsend for them. And
yes, he has.
Again, speaking objectively, if you ask me to pick a team who is going to win this division right now, I would pick the Yankees. I think they're the most balanced of the teams at the top of the division. I think, pitching and hitting, I think like we were saying earlier, Toronto certainly has the bats, but the pitching's question marks.
It is. The pitching for the Yankees will all hinge on whether CC can come back healthy. I know he's out until, I believe, July.
July.
He's got some knee problems. And Michael Pineda. I mean, when he did pitch without pine tar on his neck, he was fantastic. He was a good pitcher in Seattle before they traded for him. Power arm, power slider. He comes back okay from this minor injury he's got now. And they definitely could contend. And they will spend money.
Right.
They will be in the trade market for another pitcher or another hitter. You know, Solarte could end up being a utility guy, and Adrian Beltre could be playing third base day. You never know.
Right, absolutely. Or this could be another potential landing spot for Samardzija, of course.
Could be.
Anytime you have a guy that's going to want a lot of money like that, you think Yankees and Red Sox are usually the first two teams that come to mind.
The only thing with that is that the Yankees' farm system is sort of depleted because they're always making trades.
Right.
But, again, Solarte came from the minors.
Right. And I think with Pineda and Sabathia, the fact that Tanaka is as good as he is makes they do need to come back and they need to be good, but they don't need to be aces.
No.
You know, if CC can be, keep his ERA around four and be an innings eater for him, I mean, that's going to be good enough. And
which he definitely can do. He's a veteran pitcher. He doesn't throw as hard as he used to, but he still knows how to pitch.
Absolutely. All right. And then Baltimore. I think Baltimore is going to be a kind of a similar story to the Blue Jays in that great bats, no pitching, just no pitching. And what do you think about them, Keith?
They have Jekyll and Hyde in Ubaldo Jimenez. And his track record says he stinks in the first half of the season. And the second half, he's dynamic. If he goes back to pitching like he did last year in Cleveland, the second half of the season, he's not bad. You've got, what's his name, the number two pitcher, Chris Tillman. Had, about a rough month now. But he's shown in the past that he can get major league hitters out. ERA maybe around 3.5, but again, like Toronto, they're going to score 5-6 runs a game. It doesn't have to be that dynamic. They've got a few arms in the minors. Dylan Bundy could be back by the end of the season. Supposed to be a big-time prospect. He could help the rotation. Kevin Gausman, he's come up and hasn't fared very well in the majors yet, but neither did Clay Buchholz when he first came up. Their bullpen, that's a little shaky. Tommy Hunter is not a closer. He's on the DL now. Zach Britton has been filling in at closer. He's doing all right, but they don't like to waste a lefty at the end of a game to close out games. So we'll see with this team, too. Again, they could be another landing spot for Samardzija.
Right. They could use him because that lineup is I mean, if Toronto's a murderer's row, this is a very, very, very much a close second.
This is a kid's brother.
Especially Nelson Cruz. Are you surprised with how much he's hitting coming off the steroid suspension and everything? I mean, he's always been good, but I mean, he seems to have actually kicked it up a notch here.
He went from a great hitter's park and a great lineup in Texas to an even better hitter's park and a better lineup in Baltimore. He's playing on an $8 million deal. He's got to prove himself. Probably a little chip on his shoulder with the suspension and people thinking that that's the only reason he hit all those home runs. And he's proven now that that's not the case.
About the one-year contract, the fact that he only got 1 year and I think $8 million.
Exactly.
Because of the suspension.
That's the chip on his shoulder. And I tell you, he keeps up at this pace. He's going to get a hell of a lot more than $8 million.
He's making himself a lot of money right
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely.
I think pretty much no matter what happens the rest of the way, short of a career-ending injury, he's made himself a lot of money.
Or another suspension.
Or another suspension. We would like to think he's not that stupid, but I guess you never know.
But the rest of that lineup, I mean, shortstop, J.J. Hardy. Great glove. And he'll hit you 25 home runs. It doesn't get any better than that. Manny Machado at third base, I mean, that kid is, he reminds me a lot of A-Rod when he first came up. His power is starting to develop now. What a lineup that is. What a lineup. Yeah. Jealous.
We haven't even talked about Chris Davis. That's how good that lineup is.
There you go. And Matt Wieters. Matt Wieters on the DL. That could be a big blow if he ends up opting for surgery. They're going to wait until July to see if his soreness in his elbow gets better. If not, Tommy John is coming, and they'll have to fill that void, but the rest of the lineup will take care of that anyway.
All right. And last but not least here, we have the Tampa Bay Rays sitting six games back right now. The same story every year for this team, in my opinion, right? You have they can't quite spend the money the big boys can. They have some young talent. Their pitching's good. But it seems like, to me, the lineup just doesn't have enough pop to compete with the rest of the division. What do you think, Keith?
Yeah, they can pitch. Their lineup, like you said, is subpar to the rest of the teams, that's for sure. But they always seem to do enough. They're a scrappy, you know, Punch and Judy type hitters. And then you got Longoria. And if Will Myers can regain his form from last year, they drive in the runs. They could do it. They could do it. Their pitching staff, in my opinion, is the best in the division. And that's without Matt Moore, who's, if I'm not mistaken, he's up for the season with his elbow.
Right. Correct.
Alex Cobb, he's an ace. David Price, he's an ace. Chris Archer, ace in the making. They just seem to develop pitching over and over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, they've even turned Odorizzi into someone serviceable.
He pitched a pretty good game yesterday against the Red Sox.
And Bedard. They have Bedard in the rotation now, and he is what he is, but I mean, he's got a 2.63 ERA right now, which is pretty incredible.
It is pretty incredible.
I don't know what they've got a heck of a pitching coach over there to be able to turn these guys around.
That's for certain.
But again, I'm with you there. They're a team I think more built for the postseason than the regular season.
Yes.
In that, I mean, with that pitching, I mean, they're built to win series, but you got to get there, and I don't think they're going to be able to get there this year. They're already six games back, and all the other teams we've talked about, you know, what can we do? There are going to be things that are going to be done to help them in the future, and the Rays just don't really have that. They're not going to go get a high price guy to come in there.
They won't spend the money.
No, and I guess Will Myers is the best case for them in that he really hasn't hit at all this
not
year,
at all.
And he's, you know, his pedigree. I think he's a good hitter. If he can come, if he can start acting like a middle of the order bat that he's supposed to be, then I think they'll be in good shape. So we'll close this segment out with our we're going to do this for every division, but our predicted order of finish for the end of the season. So I'll start it off here. I'm going to go Yankees, Orioles, Red Sox, Rays, Blue Jays. So I think the Blue Jays are going first to worst by the end of the year.
Ooh.
Keith?
I will go Baltimore, New York, Toronto, Boston, Tampa.
Excellent. So thanks so much for being on, Keith. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed having you. And again, always come to a Place to Be Nation, the Sports Lounge, for all your baseball needs. Stay tuned to us. We're going to do this for every division in the majors. Allow me to rekindle. Let's all reminisce like Mary did. I think I have to send you a reminder. Here it is.
What's up, wrestling fans? This is Jeff Peck, and you can check out my wrestling podcast, The Still Real to Us Show, every Saturday right here at placetobenation.com. It is a wrestling podcast from a fan's perspective, and we're not doing it in our mom's basement. So check it out every Saturday right here at placetobenation.com.
It's still real to me, damn it!
Looking for new wrestling, sports, and pop culture voices? Head over to placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. We have an extremely talented staff that covers comics, video games, and all facets of entertainment. Our sports coverage spans all the major professional and collegiate sports, including MMA. Our fresh takes on professional wrestling are some of the best on the internet. Don't forget to check out our fantastic podcasts as well, including the voice of Ring of Honor, Kevin Kelly, exclusively at PlaceTVNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Also, be sure to check out our friends at TheHistoryOfWWE.com, ProWrestlingOnly.com, Scott Keith blog at RSPWFAQ.net, and PileDriverWrestling.net.
We used to be number 10. Now we permanent in one. In the battle, lost my finger. Mike became my arm. Pistol nozzle, it's nasal. Blood becomes lukewarm. Tell them, come on, be easy now. Squeeze this summer. Test why cleft.
Welcome back to the Place to Be Nation Sports Lounge. Cowboy Roger Morrison here with your MMA chatter, MMA update for the week. So we're taping this on a Monday, and on Saturday we had a fantastic UFC 173, which on paper looked like the main event and the co-main event were both going to be mismatches. We had Daniel Cormier and Dan Henderson, TJ Dillashaw and Renan Barro. Cormier versus Henderson certainly proved to be a bit of a mismatch. We will go in-depth into that, but first, how about TJ Dillashaw? TJ Dillashaw, about an 8-1 underdog against Renan Barro for the bantamweight title. Barro coming in on a 35-fight winning streak, dating back to 2005. Dillashaw wasn't even supposed to be in the main event on this card. Rafael Assuncao was, who owns a split decision win over Dillashaw. Assuncao got hurt, Dillashaw moved up, and this is why we watch the fights, guys. What a performance by Dillashaw. He's just a kid, and he stepped up. He stepped up when he got his chance. He won every second of this fight against Barao. It was actually shocking while it was happening. In the first round, he utilized movement kind of similar to what Frankie Edgar did to beat BJ Penn. And that was a similar shocking type of result. But he was utilizing movement and footwork to not give Barao any angles and using angles of his own. And, you know, about 3.5 minutes in or so, he landed a massive right hand and almost ended the fight right there on Barao. Landed the big right. Barao's eyes rolled up in the back of his head. Dillashaw followed up. He couldn't finish him because Barao's a great champion, a great fighter. And he survived, but he could just not get anything going. And going into the fifth round, it was perfectly clear that Dillashaw had won the first four rounds. At worst, he was ahead 3-1, at absolute worst. And a lot of guys in that scenario are especially in with a killer like Barao, who does have the ability to end the fight with one shot, as he did against Eddie Wineland with that spinning kick to the stomach. A lot of guys would have played it safe, played the four corners offense, made sure he stayed on his feet, and now he's champion. Well, Dillashaw went after him. Used the same angles, landed a vicious head kick, and then was able to put Barao away and get the knockout, that turned a great performance into, you know, a bit of a historic performance, in my opinion. Not only is the guy a huge underdog, but to go in there and go for broke in the last round when he didn't have to, this is the kind of stuff that we as fans love and that Dana White loves. And can't say enough. If you didn't order the pay-per-view, I'm sorry, because you missed just a heck of a moment with Dillashaw's coach, Dwayne Bang Ludwig, coming into the ring, crying his eyes out. Dillashaw's buddy, Uriah Faber, just going nuts in the audience. It was, again, the reason we watch the fights is for moments like this. And, you know, TJ Dillashaw, now he's the bantamweight champion. And I'm sure Barao gets a rematch somewhere down the road. But, I mean, given just how thoroughly he was dominated, I don't think he should get an immediate rematch. And I think Dillashaw should be fighting the guy who he's got some unfinished business with. That's Hasan Sal. Hasan Sal was supposed to fight Barao here. And like I said earlier, he does own a victory over Dillashaw. So chances are you're going to see those two guys in the next bantamweight title fight. But congratulations to TJ Dillashaw just on a phenomenal performance where no one I talked to thought he had a chance in hell to win the fight, never mind dominate the way that he did. It was a thoroughly stunning and just a thoroughly fantastic performance from Dillashaw. It's so nice to see a guy step up and fight his best when given that huge opportunity. So many times guys are beaten before they get to the ring when they're fighting, you know, fighting supposedly pound-for-pound best type of guys like Barao. But Dillashaw had all the confidence in the world. He had a great game plan, and he made it work. And he's deservedly your champion now in a hell of a performance. In the co-main event, we had Daniel Cormier versus Dan Henderson in a 205-pound affair. Cormier, as you probably know, was a heavyweight. He was the Strikeforce, won the Strikeforce heavyweight tournament. That's how he kind of burst onto the MMA scene. Came into the UFC as a heavyweight, but his training partner and good friend is Cain Velasquez, who's the heavyweight champion, and they won't fight each other. So because of that, Cormier has decided to drop it down to 205. He's got the frame for it, and he goes from being a small heavyweight to an absolute behemoth at 205, and he's got his eyes set on John Jones. But this was his toughest, supposedly going to be his toughest test in the UFC to date. Dan Henderson's not an easy out for anybody. He's a little bit long in the tooth at this point, but in general, he's a great fighter, great right hand, has an equalizer in that right hand that, you know, made the odds. Henderson was about a 7.5-1 underdog. Made the odds say, well, if he lands that right hand, maybe that comes in. But just from the opening second of the fight, Cormier dominated. Cormier ragdolled Henderson, just threw him around and out wrestled him. It wasn't the most exciting performance ever, but when you consider who he was doing it to, Dan Henderson's an Olympic wrestler who I've never seen like thoroughly out-wrestled in the cage. I mean, he's been on his back before, but Cormier treated him the same way that he would treat a guy on the street. I mean, Henderson just could get nothing going, could not stop the takedowns, and got beat up. And then, again, similar to Dillashaw, I was happy with Cormier in that it looked like he may be going for the lay-and-pray victory through the first two rounds, where, you know, exhibiting top control, landing some ground and pound, but not really going for that signature-type win. In the third round, he had softened Hendo enough up to that point that he was able to sink in a submission, sink in a rear naked choke, and get the submission victory to Henderson's credit. And these guys are the toughest guys in the world. To Henderson's credit, even after, I mean, he had no chance to win the fight. He's getting destroyed in all three rounds. He was going to lose a decision. He refused to tap. So he made Cormier actually choke him out, and the ref stopped it when Henderson went out. It's that type of attitude and that type of courage that these guys have, that's just incredible to me. And that's what makes Dan Henderson, regardless of the fact of whether he's lost four of his last fights or whether he's older now, I'll always tune in when Henderson's fighting. And I think you should too. But I think for Hendo, I think it's probably the end of the line as far as him squaring off against the top of the 205-pound division. I just don't think he has that in him anymore at his age. A move to 185 makes sense for him. If he can cut down there, he would enjoy a bit of a size advantage, and he could probably compete a little better at 185. For Cormier, in the ring afterwards, he said what he wanted, and I think as fans, it's what we all want too, which is Cormier versus Johnny Bones. It's a great fight stylistically on paper. Obviously, Jones still has to get through Alexander Gustafsson, which is not a given at all. If you saw their first fight, it was an absolute bloodbath. And Gustafsson is a very worthy challenger to Johnny Bones, and he could very well win their rematch. But if Jones is able to get through the rematch with Gustafsson, the fight with Cormier is a no-brainer. And he doesn't have the height, and Jones tends to dominate guys that don't have the height. But I think he's so well-rounded in that wrestling base, I think he gives Jones a lot of trouble. And if I had to pick the fight right now, I'd call it a toss-up. Which is high praise for Mr. Cormier, because Jones is probably the pound-for-pound best fighter on the planet, him or Aldo, in my opinion. And in the third-to-last fight, we had Robbie Lawler against Jake Ellenberger in a welterweight tilt. Lawler coming back as quickly as he did, I thought, was a mistake. I mean, he was in a slobber knocker with Johnny Hendricks 2 months ago for the welterweight title. I mean, a fight that, you know, you watch that fight and you're thinking this fight's taking years off these guys' career. To come back in 2 months was just crazy, in my opinion. But obviously he knows best, because he put on just a beautiful performance against Ellenberger. Ellenberger could never get anything going. Lawler just tattooed him throughout the fight before finishing him off. And, you know, I was a little reluctant to think that Robbie, after being away from the UFC for so long and kind of having such an up-and-down career, that he was really the real deal at welterweight. And even the Hendricks fight, he almost beat Hendricks. I mean, looking in the middle of that fight, he came very, very close to stopping the champ, or the eventual champ. But then it came out afterwards that Jen Hendricks was fighting with a torn bicep, or it was a very tough injury to fight through. And I said, okay, well, maybe that's why Lawler looked so good. Well, the fight against Ellenberger really proves that Lawler is an upper echelon elite guy at welterweight in the UFC, because Ellenberger is no joke, and Lawler just walked right through him. So I'd love to see Lawler fight a guy like Matt Brown, although poor Matt Brown I don't know what else he has to do to deserve a title shot, but it would be very UFC-like to put those two guys in together because there's no way in hell that that could be a bad fight. It's got Fight of the Year written all over it. Or, I mean, I think Lawler would, you know, if Hendricks is able to get through his next challenge, I mean, he should, you know, he has every right to say he's next in line given how close that first fight was. So I hope everyone who watched the UFC enjoyed it. It was a really, really good card, and a card that on paper didn't look like it justified the high pay-per-view price, but that's why I get all of them, because I've been through the years, a lot of times the fights that I think are going to be the best fights end out being flops, and the fights that are supposed to be just walkovers are exciting. And I mean, you're not going to see anything more exciting in the UFC this year than what Dillashaw did to Barao and what Dillashaw did in winning that title. So that's all we have for the UFC, and that's going to conclude the inaugural Place to Be Nation Sports Lounge. I hope you guys have enjoyed this as much as I've enjoyed doing it. And this is going to be a bi-weekly show, as we've spoken about. And we're going to be doing deep dives, just like you've seen. We're going to deep dive into a few hot-button sports topics on a bi-weekly basis and, you know, give you what we consider the best analysis around with the best experts around. So, from the ranch, Cowboy out. Till next time.